Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 18th. I'm Ray Graff. Time for one of my favorite shows in the Vox Pop lineup. It's a science forum. We have our panel of experts ready to answer your scientific questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email us if you want, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number is 800-348-2551. Any scientific question you want to throw at these people, they'll give it a shot. It's the Science Forum. Your calls are coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. Our experts are ready to field your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551 if you want to join in this edition of the Science Forum. And without further ado, let's have our panel of scientists sign in, please.
Oh, he pointed at me first. Barbara Brabets. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Hello, Raymond.
Everything good?
Yeah, really good.
Yeah?
4 weeks to go. Tick tock, tick tock.
Oh, that's beautiful. And the semester has gone well?
It's going well.
Yeah, that's good. Also, we have with us...
Roger Giaboni. I'm an electrical engineer, and I own Roger's High Fidelity.
How's it going, Mr. Roger?
It's going well.
All right.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, and I'm mostly, but not completely retired.
So you're the most relaxed person here and love it. And
it must be going well for him. He's retired.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't even ask how it's going. It's self-evident.
What's the difference between a retire and a retread? I've never quite understood.
That's a great question.
Anyway, Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, and anything that nobody else can answer.
Ed, we'll start with you.
I figured that.
Big eclipse coming up.
Big eclipse.
We won't see it because it'll be too cloudy.
No, it'll be cloudy.
Really?
According to the weather forecast as of right now, the clouds should start clearing out about 12 o'clock.
Now, this isn't a full eclipse, right?
This is 98% eclipse. So you can't get closer than that.
But it's a big deal because?
Because it's the moon at the time of the eclipse is going to be at apogee. It's going to be the farthest away it can be from the Earth. And so it's going to be the smallest going through the shadow. And as a result, it's going to be the longest eclipse in something like 500 years.
That's exciting. And
it starts about 1:30.
In the morning.
In the morning. Nice. At about 3:45 or 4 o'clock, it'll be at maximum. And as I said, that'll be 98% gone. And then it'll start opening up again after that.
So you're guaranteeing that if I get up at 1:45, it won't be cloudy?
No, I'm guaranteeing if you get up at 3 o'clock, it won't be cloudy, because that's when it's going to be really cool to watch.
So don't get up that early. All right.
Now, one of the cool things about the eclipse is that the moon used to be, when I was a kid, during an eclipse, the moon would turn black. It would disappear. But these days, instead, it becomes blood red. And there's
werewolves?
A reason for that. Huh?
Werewolves?
Exactly. Well, it's called the Beaver Moon, so I guess it's Beaver Wolves.
It's called the Beaver Moon.
Exactly.
All right, let's just let that go. All right, continue.
Okay. Anyway, back in the 1970s, the reason it turns red is because light from the sun goes through the atmosphere and gets bent a little bit, and so there's a little bit of red light that comes through, just like during a sunset on Earth.
Yeah.
Okay? So the more atmosphere the light goes through, the redder it is. So you get a red moon these days. When back in the 1970s, you got a black moon. And the reason you got a black moon back in the old days was that there's so much pollution in the atmosphere that it would stop the light. So scientists use the color of the moon to determine how clean the atmosphere is.
Oh, we're going to get a gut check as to how well we're doing by what color the moon is at 3
in
the morning?
That's exactly
right.
Nice takeaway.
I understand why you say that, Ed. But when we were in Maine this summer, there was a full moon. It popped up. It was at the same time there were all the wildfires on the West Coast.
Yep.
And the moon was really red.
Correct.
And that seems counterintuitive from what you just said.
I guess it does. The reason that the moon was red in that case was because the light from the moon was coming through the atmosphere.
And straight through.
Through the atmosphere. So it was being absorbed. The blue color and the green colors were all being absorbed.
They scatter in the dust.
Being scattered by the dust.
Gotcha.
Exactly. But in this case, it's going through the entire atmosphere and then being refracted slightly to the moon. So it's a slightly different situation.
And will you be up at that hour?
I'll be up at 3:30 in the morning. You want me to give you a call?
How about not? Barbara, will you be up?
I'm going to ask my Alexa to get me up, and then I can always tell her some expletive that I can't say on the radio.
Now, if Alexa, I don't have one of those things because I feel it's Big Brother intruding on my life.
Big sister.
Yeah, big sister.
I recognize every time you say that, everybody's pods going off.
Alexa. It's like Beetlejuice.
There is a subcarrier that will delete that.
Really?
Yes.
So in other words, over the radio, if someone's listening to the show, and there's probably
three
Alexa, or four.
And everybody's Alexa pod just lit up.
Okay. But if you said that name before you got out of bed, Barbara.
Who will not be named.
Could you say, how's the weather?
I could.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's all right.
Oh, it's a marvelous device.
It's this. You're okay with that, too?
You know what? The CIA can listen to anything they want.
Mine has mine has a microphone mute, so I can tell it I don't want to talk to it.
Theoretically.
And and it turns a different color. So I don't know if that actually works or not, but
We'll just have to go online and see if it's transcribing everything you're saying.
That's correct.
Well, there have been a few court cases, by the way, where the police have tried to subpoena the records.
Very interesting and terrifying, too. And we'll talk about the black helicopters
as well.
Yeah,
I was worrying about I was singing in the shower this morning, and I'm thinking, is Alexa recording me right now? Because I do not ever want to hear this again.
Right. Alexa said, this ain't Adele. You know?
No, she knew it wasn't Adele from the first note.
The science forum is in progress. We digress, but that's what we do. 800-348-2551 is our number. If you have a science question for our panel of experts, 800-348-2551. Let's go to somebody in Massachusetts. It's Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
You're on.
Okay, my question is I have heard that the universe expanded faster than the speed of light in the beginning. Has anybody figured out how fast it was actually going?
The suggestion is that the universe effectively sped up to the point where it is now during the first couple of thousand years, if you will, of the Earth's, of the universe's existence. In other words, it's still expanding, but at a much, much, much lower rate. As far as how fast it goes, that's a very good question. And whether it actually did go that fast is also a very good question, because as far as I know, nobody was there to see it. And the evidence for it is very, very sparse. Basically, the evidence for it is the fact that everywhere you look in the universe, the temperature of the universe is the same. And the question is, if the universe expanded slower, you'd expect some parts of it to go faster than others, and therefore the temperature at various parts of the universe would be different. But since it's all the same, it must have been in direct contact with everything very early on and then expanded equally in all directions. So that's basically the proof of it, if there is one.
Peter.
Right. So there's been no calculation of how quickly it popped.
No, it may have actually popped to the point where it's almost at its peak right now. In other words, it may not have expanded much since then.
You know, Peter, I haven't looked at the schedule exactly, but I believe there's an astronomy show coming up in the next week, maybe the next two. I think next week, but I'm not positive. Don't hold me to that. And at that time, you can ask our astronomers and our astrophysicists about that one. But thank you for the call and getting us started. 800-348-2551 is the number. What's the matter?
I'm just thinking that you've just blown me off.
Why? You want to come on the astronomy show too?
The astronomer is going to be on the show, so don't listen to
Dr. Stanley. Do you know Valerie Rapson?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. She's a good astrophysicist, right?
Yes, she is.
So you're not dissing her in any way, right?
I'm not dissing her in any way.
You want to come on the show with them too? Please do.
Oh, boys.
It's okay. Let's go on to the next question.
Oh, all right. Well, if it's all right with you, we'll do just that. And let's go to Dixie in Western Mass. Hello, Dixie.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Okay, you're on.
Yes.
Okay.
My question is, can anyone explain what the trail is following jets at times?
All
it's
right.
Not following every jet.
You want me to?
Who
go
wants
ahead.
This?
Go right.
Go ahead. So what you're seeing is condensate behind the jet engine, because of the change in temperature as a result of the exhaust gases on the engines. So they hit certain points where the atmosphere around the back of the engine raises to the dew point, or in essence, where the humidity and the air around it becomes 100% saturated, and it becomes a cloud, in essence. And that's a contrail, that's called.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same thing as the little cloud that comes out of your mouth when you breathe in the wintertime.
Uh-huh.
So it's just droplets of water, because when the fuel in the engine burns to provide the power, it generates carbon dioxide and water.
And then at some points, the dew point is not conducive to seeing those, because sometimes you'll see a plane go through
That's
and you won't see them at all.
That's correct.
Yep, and if you look closely, when you do see a contrail, for some distance behind the engine, you can't see anything.
Right.
Because it hasn't expanded and cooled down.
So very close to the jet.
So very close to the exhaust of the jet. And then some distance behind, you'll see.
Very challenging problem.
Yep.
Go ahead, finish.
And piston aircraft can do that, too. I mean, there were contrails in all over the skies in Europe in World War II.
Now, Roger, what did you mean by a challenging problem?
Very challenging problem for the classified reconnaissance aircraft, the SR-71 and the U-2, which we still fly the U-2. The SR-71 isn't flown anymore. But the big issue with that was they flew, it's classified, but somewhere between 70 and 90,000 feet. And if they drew a contrail, they could be seen.
It's game over.
Right.
So all that technology just to be invisible to radar or microwaves or whatever, and it's like, oh, looky, there it is.
Yeah. But
that's a problem.
What about the donuts on a rope? That's a different engine,
that's pulse. That's a pulse jet.
Yeah.
Right.
And I've not seen those around here. Are they commonly used nowadays?
I don't think they're commonly used nowadays. A pulse jet, the V-1 Buzz Bomb was a pulse jet.
Ah, well, I never saw one of those either. Let's take a quick break. It's the Science Forum, and we are just hitting our stride here. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett, and you. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. It's the Science Forum. Roger Jaboni, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett join us to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And an email here from Mark. This one I will throw to you, Barbara. Mark writes, I'm trying to lose some weight. The latest trend in weight loss is the keto diet. Everywhere you look, there are keto books, keto recipes, foods all over the place claiming to be keto. Is there any real science behind the keto diet, or is it just another gimmick?
Well, in my estimation, it is a gimmick, but it's a gimmick that works. The issue behind the keto diet is to limit your carbohydrate intake. And the reason why, in order to break down proteins in particular, it's very carbohydrate. You need some carbohydrates to break them down. And if you limit the carbohydrates that you're eating, you're not going to get them in your diet stream to break down the bacon or the ham. Or what other delicious food should we talk about right now?
Spam?
Spam. Yeah, break down the spam that's in your diet. So what happens is the body has to harvest your own reserves that it has, mainly in your liver and then ultimately in your other body parts that you'd like to shrink, in order to get the materials necessary to break down that protein. One of the problems with protein breakdown, you know, it's a food source, and it's a terrific food source, and, you know, I'm drooling thinking of spam, but it's hard on the kidneys because you put out uric acid or urea. That you got to get rid of the nitrogen component of proteins because amino acids have an amine group and an acid group. And my students are going, oh, my gosh, chemistry. but the amines, your body is like, yeah, we don't need a lot of those. So it sends it out, and it sends it out via the kidneys for the most part, although you do exhale some as well. It's hard on the kidneys. So anybody who's on the keto diet, I would say make sure that you see your doctor regularly. Make sure it's doctor approved. And you must drink copious quantities of water so you don't harm your kidneys.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you for that email, Mark. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Science Forum, and we go to Jim in Warwick. Jim, you're up. Massachusetts.
Hi. I have a question about primordial black holes. More specifically, ones that would be, I've been read, that could be the size of a grapefruit. And I'm curious as to how, if it were possible to actually find one, and could it be approached by humans, if that were possible, to see more about what black holes are about?
Well, fortunately, there aren't too many primordial black holes around, so there's really no way to test that one way or the other. Some comments about black holes is that a black hole effectively is a pinpoint of mass, if you will. In other words, there's a lot of mass, or there could be a lot of mass in a very small place. So the black hole itself is not very dangerous until you get very, very close to it, when the gravity becomes great. So if you had something as small as a primordial black hole, the effect of it would be almost negligible until you got within, you know, a couple of atoms of it, if you will. And before that, nothing would happen.
So the event horizon for a grapefruit-sized black hole would be like on the rind of the grapefruit, like right off?
Well, consider that a black hole itself is probably about the size of a typical classroom. It's very, very small. The size of a primordial black hole would be so small that probably nothing could fit through it.
You want to follow up, Jim?
So it would be possible, essentially, to hold one in your hand, if indeed that were possible.
I don't think you should do that.
I have never tried it, but I wouldn't do it myself.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, the Science Forum, with Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, Barbara Brabets, and Jim Pickett. And let's go to Colony, New York. And Lewis, you're on. Hello, Lewis.
Hi, you're looking for Lewis.
Yeah.
Quick question. And I'm having trouble hearing you right now, but it should be okay.
Okay.
I just want to know which part of the sky and how high I should be looking for the moon at, let's say, 3:30.
Well, first of all, an eclipse occurs when the moon is full. And the full moon occurs when the sun sets. So effectively, as the sun sets, the moon will be coming up. And then it's going to go across the sky. It takes 6 hours to get to the top. So let's say 6 o'clock, 12 o'clock, midnight, it should be straight up in the sky. So 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, it'll be in the lower hemisphere, lower quadrant, and effectively you just look for the moon.
Yeah.
You can't miss it.
Yep. Southwest.
Southwest. Lewis, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. It's the Science Forum today. And let's go to Dalton. And Dan, you're on.
Yeah, my question is navigation in space. I'm just, you know, being a vacuum, is it actually possible to navigate with thrusters? Or, I mean, what are they pushing against? I mean, do they set their course when they're still in atmosphere, say to go to the moon or something, and that's it? Or
we're talking about navigation or propulsion.
They're like rock, paper, scissoring of who to go first.
Yeah. So the way a rocket motor works is that it works by pressing against the top of the rocket engine. So you can think of the expanding gas going in all directions. The going through the nozzle, there's no pressure there pushing to push against. It works best in a vacuum. Whereas then the expanding gas against the top of the engine exerts a pressure, pushes on it. So it's not what the rocket engine is pushing against is the engine itself, not what's behind the engine. So it works just fine in a vacuum.
And typically, the spacecraft thrusters are using hydrazine, although they now use ion motors on some of them, I believe.
Yeah.
And if you want to speed up your aircraft or your spacecraft, then what you do is go near a planet. And as you get near the planet, it'll automatically speed up by gravitational assist.
Little slingshot. Dan, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. This email from Tig in Chesterfield, maybe, I guess, New Hampshire. When I use power tools while listening to AM radio on headphones, I get disruption, but not with FM, wondering why. Roger, you're the stereo guy. Go ahead.
We'll ask General Armstrong that question. The reason is AM radio is amplitude modulated. That's what it stands for. And amplitude modulation varies the signal intensity with the modulation. Static, which your power tool is creating, also varies its amplitude with the modulation of the motor. So it creates amplitude modulated static. The radio can't tell the difference between the station and the static. Typically, static is very broadband, so no matter where you're tuned on the dial, it's going to hear that. FM, on the other hand, is frequency modulated, and instead of varying the amplitude of the signal, it varies the frequency and phase of the signal. The frequency and phase of static is not varying with the source, so it does not interfere with FM radio, the primary driver behind the creation of FM radio.
You know, the once I got a chance to borrow a spectrum analyzer, it's shocking how much RF pollution is out there all the time, especially if you're in a city. It's crazy.
And if you're interested in a follow-up, Google a gentleman by the name of Edwin Armstrong, who created designed FM radio. He's quite an interesting gentleman, and his relationship with RCA, very interesting.
And that goes back to, what, the 30s?
40s.
40s.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. Back in the early days, we had, some old car, and we replaced the radio. And when we did so, we could hear the kind of like engine whine actually in the FM stereo. And we had to buy a little something from Radio Shack. God bless us. It was a filter. I don't know what kind of a filter it was. Maybe a capacitor of some sort. No, I don't know.
High pass or a low pass?
All it did is kind of diminish it. It never really went away. It just made it a little bit more tolerable to listen to Billy Idol, I guess.
Whine, to Billy Idol. Oh, you should have left the static on it.
Whine is different than the pop, pop, pop of the spark plug spark.
It was a whine, for sure.
Very similar to static.
Yeah.
Whereas the whine comes from the alternator. And it comes through the power circuit into the radio, which is why you put that filter on the power circuit.
Got it.
Very interesting. During the Vietnam War, we actually had a classified program that traced truck static in order to find the Viet Cong on the trails.
So interesting.
Like a headset, and somebody's out there with a directional radio looking for wine?
They were aircraft mounted, but they could actually follow the trucks based on their ignition noise.
I remember reading a book about World War II espionage, and I believe we did this, and maybe the Germans as well. They would take the, not harmonics, but the mixing signal, and they could spot a receiver. Not a transmitter, but you could spot a receiver that way.
So what is called a superheterodyne receiver, which is where the frequencies, the received frequency is mixed with an oscillator and then brought down to an intermediate frequency that can be decoded, called a superheterodyne receiver, which was standard up until just recently. That local oscillator acted like a transmitter.
Yeah.
And it got out of the receiver's antenna.
This is now we're really in the weeds. Let's go back to the calls. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboney, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets. And let's go to Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're up.
Yay, Ray.
Hello.
Yes, sir. I have a question, and I've since developed a second question while I was listening to the program.
Tremendous.
The first question is, what day is this eclipse you're speaking of going to occur? No one said anything about it on the weathercast or anything on the station all day here until this program now.
I can't believe
that. Oh, that's because we're special. We know more than anyone else. It's tomorrow. It's tonight, if you
tonight,
want,
tomorrow.
Or tomorrow morning.
Right.
Starts about 1:30 tomorrow morning, and it'll go on to about 6.
Okay, fair enough. And you have
and
a
second question. The second question is, could someone please explain in terms that a layman might be able to comprehend how an ion motor actually works, what it does, what it consists of, or whatever.
An ion motor.
I can do that.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Jim.
So an ion motor takes a molecule or an atom and strips an electron from it, so it's electrically charged. It can then be accelerated by an electric field and shot out the back of the motor. And because every action has the reaction, shooting the ion backwards pushes the engine forwards.
Well, how do you create mass?
Excellent.
So the key is getting this electron off or on to create an ion and then the electric field to accelerate mm-hmm. it.
And what creates the electric field? See, I'm confused at how you can use this to do a long trip in space if you have to create the electric field.
You use like solar panels or something.
Electromagnet of some sort.
To get the energy to create the mm-hmm. electric field.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's not free energy. You still need a power source.
But it doesn't require
a lot of propellant.
Hydrazine, right. They run out of propellant. That's typically why satellites end up dying. It's not because the solar panels don't work or the radios don't work. It's because they ran out of hydrazine and can't keep the satellite in its ephemeris orbit.
Because an important thing about how rocket fuel works is the velocity of the exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
And chemical rockets have limited exhaust velocity, whereas accelerating an ion, you can get very, very high velocities. So with throwing less stuff overboard, you can get more thrust.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for the call. It is the Science Forum on WAMC. Fred in Colony is on. Hello, Fred.
You got me?
Go ahead. Yeah, you're Fred. Yes.
Okay. I was about last year, maybe about this time, I was driving along the Route 32 going north near the Alcove Reservoir. Okay. It was very overcast, kind of drizzly day. It was almost sunset. Now, I could see a rainbow against this bleak background. It was very, very dull, but it was a rainbow. Then all of a sudden, on my left, to the west and the north, I saw this. I'd say it looked like a tornado, but was very, very colorful, very, very vivid. The most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And there was, it seemed to be about, say, 3 feet in diameter, about 15, 20 feet high. And as I drove, it was kind of moving through the dark trees.
Yikes.
And anyway, it lasted probably a few seconds, a half a minute or something. And as I drove, it got smaller and smaller in diameter, and then it kind of disappeared. I haven't a clue what it was. I told my daughter about it. She said she saw the same thing, and she started telling me about it. And then I said, well, was it the same day as mine? Oh, she said, no, this was several years before. And she told me exactly where it was terminated in the reservoir itself, right on the west north corner of the reservoir.
Hmm.
I haven't a clue.
Well, let's see if somebody has a clue. Barbara, do you have a clue?
Just that there's no reason why a tornado and a rainbow couldn't be together at the same time. You could have, if you have the tornado with its particles of both water and dust that's occurring right where in your line of sight for a rainbow, there's no reason why the rainbow wouldn't occur within the tornado. I can imagine how pretty it looks.
The rainbow was very, very dim. This was ultra bright. And it was like the left-hand corner of the rainbow just sticking behind the trees. Huh. And it was rotating. And all the different colors are very, very bright. I couldn't imagine it.
I was going down a different path. I was thinking St. Elmo's fire.
Okay, Roger, go ahead. Say that into the microphone.
I said I was going in a different direction than Barbara. I was thinking St. Elmo's fire.
Which is, for those who don't know?
It's basically a charged gas, an ionized, temporarily ionized charged gas, and it glows and it moves.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't. And it has multiple colors in it. It wouldn't necessarily keep the Roy G. Biv order that you would see in a rainbow, but it would be spectacularly colored, which is why you hear me kind of silent, because being brighter than the rainbow itself, I can't really come to grips with why that would be.
I can see why it could be brighter, and that's simply because the light was so near the horizon.
The colors weren't arranged like a rainbow. It was all there. So bright. Yeah. So beautiful.
My guess is that the amount of water that was inside it, sort of like a water spout or a dust devil,
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, there was enough water in it that the light from the sun was refracting off the
the larger droplets
in it.
Kind of like a dust particle phenomenon.
Right.
Well, Fred, thank you. We have to take a break. That was a very interesting call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets, Ed Stender, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett. This email is from Peter. I heard that the fusion researchers recently made a 200 Tesla magnet. How soon do the coal plants shut down? And that's from Peter. What is it? What is a 200 Tesla magnet?
Well, that would be an extremely strong magnet. And yes, that is a advance for fusion technology because you use the strong magnetic field to contain the plasma where the fusion's taking place. But fusion is probably and has been and always will be 30 years away.
Yeah, why is that? I mean, we the H-bomb is 60 years old or however, older than that, I don't know. But they can't control it in a reactor?
Yes.
And make it economically viable as a means of...
Yeah.
As a means of electricity generation, yeah. Power generation.
So it's, I've heard of the analogy that it's like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard to control and contain.
But you can do it. You could nail Jell-O to a wall. Yeah. If you're really quiet.
Probably.
All right. Let's go now to Cherry Valley and Bob. Bob, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, with all this rain we've been having, do I have to worry about my water lines out to the barn freezing this year?
How
is
deep
it going to make a difference?
Just because they're below the frost line.
Are they below the frost line? How deep are they?
Well, that's, you know, with all the ground being so wet, is the frost going to go down faster, easier?
Barbara's shaking her head.
No, it won't. The moisture content of the ground doesn't necessarily dictate where the frost line is. It really just has to do with how long and how cold we get. And, of course, you know, you need soil. You know, if it's rock, it doesn't really matter where the frost line is. You know,
no,
some people
clay.
Who live in the Helderbergs, right, they live right on rocks. So they're like, yeah, frost line, schmoss line. They don't care.
But Bob has clay, so I guess he has to worry about it.
Yeah.
There's one thing to consider is that air is a really good insulator. Water is not a good insulator. So if you put enough water in the ground, it can cool faster. It can freeze faster.
But it won't freeze deeper.
It won't freeze deeper. You'll still stop it by 3 to 4 feet maximum. Around here, I believe in this area, 3 to 4 feet is how far the line has to be down to make sure it doesn't freeze.
I think code is 48 inches, so that gets you to the end of the 4 feet.
That's 4 feet.
Yep.
All right, Bob, thank you for the call, and thank you for clearing that up, Ed. It's the Science Forum, and this is the sort of expert analysis.
It's math. You know, I spent years studying it.
Math is hard.
Yeah, it is.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551, and Jesse's in Beckett, Massachusetts. Jesse, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wondering, kind of conversation, how you're feeling about, like, the massive military buildup around the world, the weaponizing of space, the targeting of mock warships in the deserts of China, and where do you think we're really going with all this?
Well, it's a political question, but I'm going to throw it to our scientists very quickly. Ed.
Thanks. weaponization of space? I'm not too worried about it myself, but then again, I haven't really studied it. I'm not a weapons expert.
Creation of all the particulate matter,
Russian tests this past week. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is a danger. Just simply
because shot a satellite out of space.
Yeah.
And because it's so low mass, it takes forever to you know to decay.
Anybody else want to comment?
But
on
not
that?
Only that, like we.
Go ahead.
We have
Jesse.
Not only that, like China's following our satellites around with satellite killers and some sort of weapon trailing. And I just wondered if you guys had any comment how you felt. Where are we going with all this? You know, I mean, I know it's a political question, but it's just...
Well, if I could put a little science spin on it, you know, what I'm worried more about, I think, is the entropy that the situation, as it gets more complex, can create. Entropy is this force in the universe that allows things to become more random or broken down, less organized. And, you know, there can be a lot of unintended consequences here where there could be a kind of a coalescence of unintended things that then end up being a little bit more destructive than we would expect, I guess I could say.
Yeah, and blowing up satellites in low Earth orbit is just a really, really bad idea.
Do you think the Russians know how bad of an idea that really was?
Where do you think they got the idea?
Yeah, I know.
All right, Jesse, thank you for that one, and maybe we'll bring that one up again on another show. That was a fun topic. Joe in Middle Grove. Joe, you're on.
Hi, Ray and all.
Hello.
So this is something that's been bothering me, well, I've been wondering about for quite a while. They sent the Voyager out when I was still in high school, and I remember, you know, what a big deal that was, and now they are so far away, and I'm told they're still sending back information.
Once a year.
I mean, it can't be too many watts, and I just wonder how they managed to sift the signal out of what has got to be like an overwhelming amount of noise.
Well, that's a very good question. That's a path loss calculation, and the way they do that is they do use a very low bandwidth, which limits the whole challenge in receiving radio signals is what's called the signal-to-noise ratio. It's actually a challenge in everyday life, right? It's your ability to interpret information and keep it separate from the noise. So we refer to what's called a signal-to-noise ratio. Atmospheric noise, thermionic noise, the wider the bandwidth, meaning the more information you're trying to transmit, the more noise is captured in that receiver bandwidth. So what they do is they narrow the bandwidth way down, very low data rates, bits per second, not gigabits per second.
I think
bits
I read
second.
Something like 3 baud. Remember baud? Yeah. We used
to
use baud.
Yeah.
But I think Voyager
that allows
runs at like
them
3
to achieve
baud.
Workable signal to noise ratios. And then they can do enhancements. They use encoding, which means they send the same bit multiple times in a previously arranged sequence, so that if they miss it one time, they get it the next time. There are ways around it, but you're right on the money there. It's a challenging problem.
They use really big antennas.
Yeah, and right. Should mention that the Voyagers were one of the only ones sent up there with plutonium engines, and so they have a good amount of energy to be able to send things back. And when they do send a signal up to Voyager, effectively it's like sorite. 7 hours. 7 hours later,
I believe
much.
They're thermionic piles. I believe they're decaying radioactive piles.
Correct.
You know, you often heard, or one often would hear in the old days, that, the aliens on Alpha Centauri are watching the Lucy show now. It's arriving. Do we have any idea if any of our TV signals could ever make it that far?
Well, they do. They disperse on a square, of distance.
That's a long way away.
Long ways away, but it's still out there.
I mean, will they be hearing us on Alpha Centauri at some point?
I certainly hope so.
I'm putting that on my resume.
Well, yes. Well, let's go back to the phones, and we go now to Willie in Schenectady. Willie.
Hello.
Hello.
I've been saving some articles that there's been some claims of disproving of the Big Bang. I wonder what points they have that they think support their position.
That I don't know. I mean, the Big Bang theory is pretty well established. I'm not aware of any really serious serious evidence to refute it.
Yeah, I'll get your email and send them to you.
Okay.
I'm sure that you'll be able to find stuff on the internet.
No, I think I saw something like from National Geographic, or it wasn't NASA. I remember seeing, but I didn't. I was too tired and I needed to find my glasses to read it, so I didn't read it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Willie, send it to voxpop@wamc.org, and at the very least, I will bring it up when we do the astronomy show with our three astronomers, now that Ed is going to be joining us, and I believe that's next week. And so, Willie, thank you for that one. And we go now to Martha in Gansvoort. Martha, you're on.
Hi. I've had a problem that's been very vexing. I had an old TV, and I got the digital converter box, and it never... It never, never have a blind dog that's fussing with the other one. At any rate, I had a converter box, but it would periodically, picture would fragment all the time. Mm-hmm. And yet it would clear up, and then it could go months without fragmenting.
Yeah.
And finally my family gave me an LED flat screen, and it started to fragment, but then my niece put on some rabbit ears, and it cleared up, and it was working beautifully until Saturday. And then it just was blitzing and, you know, fragmenting, and I couldn't see it. And then the next day, it was absolutely fine. Now, is this humidity? Is this, what is it that's causing that?
Well, we're all nodding.
The
but
TV itself is fine, but it's the reception.
We all have a solid idea on this one, and since I saw Ed nodding first, we're going to throw it to Ed.
Okay, well, basically, the problem with digital television is that the signal is no longer a wave. It's numbers. And if you don't get the number, then it blitzes out.
It's either there or not there.
It's either there or it's not there, exactly. And so basically, humidity or anything in the way of the wave path that knocks out the signal for even a second will cause blitzing. So that's basically what's going on.
This is a signal strength issue, right,
that's
Roger?
Right.
Back to noise.
Yeah, back to noise. So, Martha, you should put an outside antenna up there or get a preamp on your rabbit ears.
And well, you just got a solid-state digital TV. My suggestion would be is the cable box you're using has an RF output. What you want to do is go back to your cable provider, get a standard cable box that
cable.
Has...
No, it's antenna. This is over the air.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah, this
oh,
is...
Okay.
Well,
okay.
It's rabbit ears because the other one was attached to an old antenna, but then my niece and nephew disconnected it and just connected it to rabbit ears.
So if you go onto Amazon or any of the online service providers, you can find a digital TV antenna with a built-in preamp.
Some of them are lousy, by the way. I've put them in play, and they're not that good.
But I watch the Albany stations via RF and broadcast, and it's great.
So it's really, Martha, it's a question of you not getting – so you mentioned humidity. Could be. I mean, if the signal's just on the edge of being receivable, things like that could definitely play in. So either get an antenna that's a higher, that always helps, or get a preamp.
Okay, now what sort of antenna should I get? I'm 75, and I don't know much about these things. What?
A TV antenna.
And what you might want to do is go on the internet, and you can find out from where you are which direction the antenna should be pointed to get the best signal for what you're looking for.
You remember the old days, Martha, when everybody had TV antennas outside that, and a lot of them, you know, the fancy ones turned. You had a little rotator, and they would turn. We never had that in my day. We just fixed it in one place. But, you know.
Yeah, that's the way mine was.
The inside antennas there, they cause endless. In the old days of analog TV, and I'm sure all of our panel would back me up, you know, it would get a little fuzzy, but you could watch it. Now it's there or it's not there. As you say, fragmenting, Martha.
And
one thing you should do, by the way, is keep it away from any walls. The higher up in the house it is, and keep it away from walls because you can get effects associated with the antenna can actually be blocked by the wall if it's close enough.
Interesting.
Look under a manufacturer that goes by the name of Channel Master.
Oh, yeah, they're old school.
Right.
Yeah.
And they make a number of direct broadcast digital antennas that have built-in preamps.
Interesting.
And you get that up in your attic somewhere. And if you have a skylight in the attic or something like that, up near the skylight.
Yep.
And that'll improve it significantly.
The higher the better, too. I mean, that generally works as long as it's not so far that the feed you lose all the power in the feed line. Let's go to Chris in Hurleyville. Chris.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually have a physics joke.
Oh, good.
Goody.
An up note to end on. Ohm, Heisenberg, and Schrodinger are in a car, and they're on their way to lunch at a restaurant. Heisenberg is driving, and they get pulled over. The cop asks him, "Do you know how fast you were going?" Heisenberg smiles at the cop. "No, but we know exactly where we are." The cop says, "You were doing 55 in a 35. Heisenberg throws up his hands and shouts, "Great, now we're lost."
All All right,
the cop thinks this is suspicious and orders him to pop the trunk.
Oh, no.
He walks to the back of the car, looks in the trunk, and says, "Ew, do you know you have a dead cat back here?" "Now we do, Dummkopf," shouts Schrödinger.
Well,
cop yells,
"We're not done yet."
Cop yells, "That's it. Everybody out. You're all under arrest." Heisenberg and Schrödinger comply, but Ohm resists.
Yes.
Ohm resists.
The end.
Where were you at 8 o'clock this morning when I was trying to explain the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to a group of general chemistry students?
Do you want Chris to repeat it? We only have about 40 seconds.
I'm going to take the podcast and I'll play it next time.
Hey, Chris, thank you for that one. Let's see. We'll see if we can squeeze one more question in here. And this is from Utica, New York. Roger, you got about a minute.
Yeah, probably better next week on the astronomy show. But briefly, what's the story on the new comet that's supposedly discovered earlier this year and going to be visible here like in November, December?
Anybody know about that one?
It's hard to say whether it's going to be visible or not. It's just starting to develop a tail. Basically, that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, the only thing remarkable about that comet is that it's really big. It's not going to get very close. And I think the chances of seeing it with the naked eye are low.
What's the name of it?
We don't know.
Idea.
It's probably a bunch of numbers and a bunch of letters.
Call next week. Ed will have the answer for you on the astronomy show. Roger, thank you very much for that question. We have very little time. Pwn in Lanesville, you're on.
Hi. So for those of us a little more intimately connected to the moon and feel, you know, maybe besides themselves on a full moon, I'm just curious if there is an actual measurable or a way to measure the pull the moon has on the body, the water of the body, just as the moon has an influence on the water bodies of the Earth. Is it fair to say that it has a similar effect to the human body?
Okay, we have 30 seconds. I see Jim champing at the bit.
Yeah, the answer is no.
I
mean,
it's
infinitesimal. It works to make tides only because the oceans are huge.
I was going to say, look at your tide charts.
But it only works because the oceans are huge. It doesn't work in a lake.
But there are Earth tides as well.
The
Earth actually rises about 1 or 2 centimeters when the moon's up above it.
Yeah.
So there is an effect, but it's probably minimal.
Yes.
I guess that's
so we can measure it.
We will have to leave it. But thank you very much to everybody who called in. Hey, gang, great job. We will see you next time on the Science Forum. Support comes from Friends of Chamber Music, presenting the Dover Quartet in concert November 20th, 7:30 in Page Hall on the downtown campus of the University at Albany. For ticket information, friendsofchambermusic.org. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. Studio KTM Hair Salon, welcoming Jake Dingler, direct from New York City, joining Kristen Marquette for private one-client in-salon appointments. StudioKTM.com. And Watercolors by Edith Schutzbury. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs, no contact required, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Once again, thanks to Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett for joining us today. Thank you all for listening. Terrific calls and emails. Very much appreciated. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Chekai took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., well, by golly, it's a Food Friday tomorrow. We welcome back one of our buddies. Jennifer Clare will be here to get us ready for Thanksgiving. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you for that. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.